Hello, and welcome to New Books in Sports. My name is Bruce Berglund, and I'm your host. Each week, we choose a noteworthy new book on some corner of the world of sports, and we interview the author. This week, we're talking baseball. Our guest is Lee Congdon, author of the book Baseball and Memory, Winning, Losing, and the Remembrance of Things Past. Much more than other sports played in the United States, baseball has a profound connection to Americans' collective memories and their sense of nostalgia. Some have argued that this linking of baseball to history is a remnant of America's rural past, that baseball reminds us of the small pastoral communities of more than a century ago. To Lee Congdon, though, the spark of baseball memory is not the rural life of the 19th century, but the urban ballparks of the 1950s. The time of greats like Musial, Mays, and Matthews, and unsung players like Larry Doby and Andy Pafko, and an era of legendary teams like the Yankees and Dodgers, Cleveland and Milwaukee, and his beloved Chicago Cubs. Lee sees the 50s as a golden age for baseball, a time before free agency, expansion, and drug scandals tarnished the game's traditions. You may not agree with him in extolling the 50s, but Congdon's book does spur baseball fans to think anew of why we watch and what we remember. Hopefully our conversation does a bit of the same. Here's the interview. Lee, welcome to New Books in Sports. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Bruce. Pleasure to be here.
So let's start talking about your background. A good part of the book describes your youth in Chicago and your roots as a Cubs fan. But your academic career brought you far beyond the friendly confines. Can you talk a bit about your academic work, and then how were you drawn back to write about baseball?
Sure. I think my father, as I mentioned in the book, took me out to Wrigley Field in 1948. I was 9 years old at the time and became a Cub fan. And I think, like most young men, I thought I might like to become a baseball player. And I played Little League ball and Pony League ball, and I was not too bad a player, but it wasn't too long before I realized that I couldn't hit a curveball, and so I knew that I was going to have to make my living some other way. So after college, I spent 3 years in the Army and learned Hungarian at the Army Language School. And when I got out, I worked for 2.5 years for Encyclopedia Britannica as an editor and writer, and I thought I might make my career as an editor and writer for publishers. But then I decided I'd like to do a PhD, which I did, and I was lucky enough to get a job at what was then Madison College in Virginia, now James Madison University. And I taught there for 33 years, or rather, I was on the faculty there for 33 years. And I taught history, mainly European intellectual history and East European history, mainly on Hungarian matters, but in all of Eastern Europe. And I taught there until 2005 when I retired, and now I devote myself mainly to writing. When I retired, it gave me more time to do writing I'd wanted to do, and I had completed what amounts to a trilogy on 20th century Hungarian intellectuals during the time I was teaching. And I had in the back of my mind first to write a book about George Kennan, whom I had the pleasure of meeting during the year I spent at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton in the early 80s. And since my political views are very close to Kennan's, and I've been a long-time admirer, I wanted to write a book about him. I went back and spent a month at the Institute in summer of 2007 and published a book about Kennan as a writer. And when I was done with that, I'd had in the back of my mind a book about baseball, and particularly about what the book eventually turned out to be, a book about baseball and memory. I think I'm not the only one who's noticed that there's a connection between the two. Roger Angel has pointed this out, and many others. I had written a piece about it for a magazine about 20 years ago, but since I was doing this other work on Hungarian history and the Kennan book, I didn't get around to it until a couple of years ago.
So right from the start of the book, you cite authors that one doesn't normally associate with baseball books. People like T.S. Eliot, the French philosopher Paul Ricoeur, Czech novelist Milan Kundera. So how did a lifetime of reading in European philosophy and literature shape your perspective of baseball?
Well, that's a good question. I have done a lot of reading both in European intellectual history and people like Eliot. So I have this kind of stored up in my mind certain things they wrote about, and some of them seem to fit in well with the whole subject of memory. Of course, Ricoeur wrote a whole book about memory and had some very interesting things to say about them. I wanted the book to be a serious book. It's meant to be a serious book, but I didn't want it to become deadly serious either. Mm-hmm. So I tried to show some of the funnier sides of baseball as well. But you know, if you live as long as I've lived, and you're a reader, you sort of build up, as you probably know, you build up this sort of store of things that sayings that you read and you sort of remember, and when they seem to just be right for what I was talking about in the baseball book, I use them. Mm-hmm.
So the central theme of your book is memory, and you just talked about Ricoeur's book on memory. And in your book, not only Ricoeur, but your book also looks at and responds to other scholars who have written about memory and history. Can you give us something of an overview of how scholars have come to view history and memory? And then how does baseball, in your view, offer an answer to this scholarly view of memory?
Well, there's been one of the things I learned on. I mean, I was sort of aware of the quite a number of books on memory, especially the Great War and Modern Memory that Paul Fussell wrote and that I sometimes used in classes. Then I became aware that there are a large number of books on memory, and in fact, it turns out that there has been this kind of systematic sort of turn to memory in historical studies. One of the things I found out when I read some of these books and read about the whole business of the turn to memory is that, while this is not true of every book, in many of them, the attitude is that memory is not really to be trusted, and that what we think we remember is, in fact, being a way of manipulating the public mind into thinking things that are untrue. And I got to thinking about that, in my view, this is not true, although it's obviously true that memory can play tricks on us. And as I indicated in the book, there are ways you can check your memory, because we have shared memories and because there are confirming evidence and obits and things like that. So that it does seem to me that for any historian, memory has largely be trusted. I mean, otherwise, why do we bother trying to question those who belong to what's called the great generation before they pass on? Because we think that their memories can help us understand the past. Not that they're infallible. No one claims that, but along with other evidence that it can be reliable. And so I got to think that a lot of this effort is an effort to discredit the past and to manipulate the past in the way that Orwell talked about in 1984, where the party manipulates the past and tries to control memory in order to lead its citizens to think and act in certain ways. So I think this is a danger, and I think baseball encourages us the habit of memory. And for baseball fans who are serious fans, I think they often have extremely good memories about past baseball events and past players. And I think this has encouraged them, the sort of the discipline of memory. We have we live in a time when students, as you probably know, don't seem to know much of anything about the past that's not sort of ideologically imposed on them. They're not subjected to the disciplines we had when we were young, that of memorization, and so there's a kind of discipline on learning how to train your memory. So I think baseball for serious fans is a help to, you know, encouraging this habit of memory, and I hope it helps encourage people to remember the past as clearly as we can, to the way it was, so we're not being manipulated for political purposes.
So your book covers really all eras of baseball history, but you pay specific attention to the 50s. And so this is the decade when you came of age as a baseball fan, but you make the argument following others that this was baseball's golden age. So what made the 50s special in baseball history?
There's so much. That's a good question. I think that there are so many things. For one thing, there were fewer teams. There are only 8 teams in each league, and so it was fairly easy to follow what was going on in baseball. Now, you know, some of these teams, 30 teams, you can hardly remember who they are. I think that since there were fewer teams, the players, the level of play was higher. There's simply not as enough outstanding players to go around to 30 teams, not at least on the 50s standards. The game was always a business to some degree, of course, but it was a game too, where now it's strictly a business. And partly that's because of the big money that's involved in the game now that wasn't involved in the 50s. The players, most of the players had off-season jobs because they couldn't, or they had difficulty living on their salaries, even though they were making more money than most American workers were making. But they weren't making these fabulous salaries. So I think, you know, it was more of a game that Roger Cowan called his famous book about the 50s Dodgers, 40s and 50s Dodgers, as the boys of summer, whereas George Will called his book Men at Work, and because Mr. Will prefers the contemporary game, and there's something to that. It is more less of a game now than it was in the 50s. There were no things like the designated hitter that they have in the American League. There was an interleague play, which is sort of destroyed the mystique of the World Series, where you have the two best teams in each league come together and play one series at the end of the season. This was before the steroid scandals that has just been absolutely devastating to the game. And it was a game that was played within the context of a country that was, in my opinion, a better country than it's become. So part of the book is about the decline of the game over since the 50s, and is a parallel to the decline of the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and reading the book, it really is an elegy to 1950s baseball. And an interesting twist you have in your book is that a recurring character is the umpire, Jocko Conlon. And so can you say a bit about your connection to Conlon and the perspective that he, as an umpire, brings to the episodes that you describe in your book?
Sure. Jocko was a great character and is a Hall of Fame, one of the several Hall of Fame umpires. My father was a wholesale florist in Chicago, and Jocko opened a retail florist shop in the city to help supplement his income. He didn't make enough money to support himself and his family just as an umpire in those days. So my father got to know him fairly well, and he took me to see him on a couple of occasions at his florist shop. I remember as a very kindly, short Irishman. He was awfully nice to me. He would find out players who were favorites of mine, and then get balls autographed, signed by them. He got me baseball caps. I think the first one was from Sid Gordon, the Giant outfielder. Once he took a ball all around the National League and had famous players from the 50s, including Musial and Jackie Robinson, people like that, signed the ball for me. It was an opportunity to get to a certain amount of inside outlook at baseball through Jocko. And, you know, he just seemed to be one of these umpires, rather like Andy Pafko, the player, who just seemed to be around on the field during important games. So, and he was a legendary umpire. He was great fun to watch out there. He was a very dramatic umpire. So that had a lot to do with, you know, encouraging my interest in the game.
Yeah, and as I said, so it's interesting in having read baseball books, you typically get the perspective of players who played in the games, but it's not very often that you hear the perspective of an umpire who was on the field and remembers certain plays.
No, that's quite true. And he did do a sort of an autobiography. It was really written by Robert Kramer, or Kramer, I'm not sure how you pronounce his name, the writer for Sports Illustrated, and it's rather a charming memoir of his life. Both he had played for the White Sox for a short time, and then became an umpire and had a Hall of Fame career, calling balls and strikes and other plays.
So, in a short section of the book, you discussed the pitcher Jim Brosnan, who wrote a diary during the 1959 season. That was later published as a book called The Long Season. And you have a brief line regarding Brosnan that I want to ask you to elaborate on. I'm going to read this line. You wrote, quote, "Brosnan revealed what one might call the prose of the game, or what the players were like as men, warts and all. But he showed us little or nothing of the game's poetry," end of quote. So could you talk a little bit about this, the prose and poetry of baseball, and perhaps, in your view, what is more significant for our memory of baseball?
Yes, that's a good question. I admire Brosnan in a lot of ways. He was a pretty good pitcher, and he wrote himself two pretty good baseball books, in which he did, just as the quote indicates, he would tell us what the players are like. And so we find out that some of them, including Brosnan, drank too much. They chased women, or they checked out women in the stands. They complained about their salaries and about their managers, and so they come across as sort of not all that heroic. And Brosnan's book, although I think it's a much better book, was in the sort of the same category as Jim Boughton's famous or infamous Ball Four, which he reveals some of the shenanigans of Mantle and other Yankee players, Billy Martin. I take it that most of these stories are true, and they do give you an idea of that these are human beings. But on the other hand, that's not why we remember these people. We remember them for what they did on the playing field. And the sort of magic moments that we remember, a great catch or a clutch hit or a certain grace that, for example, DiMaggio had in the outfield, or the tremendous home runs Mantle would hit. So that's why we remember them. We don't remember them for the fact that they weren't perfect, and some of them were a good bit less than perfect. And I think Brosnan does a good job of showing you what that was like. But that's not why we remember these people, and it really doesn't touch on some of the miraculous things that they were able to do on the baseball field and some of the heroic things they did on the field.
So thinking about the literary aspects of baseball, I want to ask you about two terms that appear in your book, fate and tragedy. And I was thinking as I read the book, is there something about baseball as opposed to other sports that makes dramas of fate and tragedy within the game particularly stark?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I do think there is something particularly about the game. There's so many, I forget the fate business, but there's so many tragedies in the game. Some of them I mentioned. One of them was, of course, the day that Herb Scores got hit in the face with a line drive off McDougal's bat, and he was never the same after that. A pitcher who was probably on his way to the Hall of Fame, and really his career pretty much came to an end when that happened. Or Pete Reiser running in the walls in the outfield and cutting his career short, or Conigliaro, who's also got hit in the face by a pitch ball. And so there are a lot of tragedies that associated with the game. A lot of what might have been, if Manuel hadn't had the injuries to his legs that he had. I think baseball gives you more sense of tragedy than other sports do. As far as the fate is concerned, there are. I talk mainly about poor Ralph Branca, who threw the pitch to Bobby Thompson that Thompson hit out that won the 1951 championship for the Giants. And it was his fate in the sense that he was summoned from the bullpen and he almost wasn't summoned. And if he hadn't been, of course, he would never have thrown the pitch, and then he would never have been a kind of subject of endless stories about the man who gave up threw the pitch to Thompson that lost the series for the Dodgers. So I do think the game, without wanting to making the game sound like it's not nothing but deadly seriousness, I do think that there's an element of tragedy and of fatefulness in the game that you don't experience in other sports.
So you make a point that I found especially important, that baseball teaches us that failure is a constant in life. Can you say a bit more about that?
Yes, I think that's true. As all baseball fans know, you don't have to be a Cub fan or Twins fan to know that baseball really is more about losing than about winning. Even the best teams, even the Yankees, fail to win the pennant more often than they win it. Although in the 50s it didn't seem that way. Even the best hitters, Rogers, Hornsby, Ted Williams, even at during their best years when they hit 400, over 400, still fail to hit 60% of the time safely. So baseball is largely about losing, and this is something that I think all sort of serious fans recognize. I found, I quoted some of them, Roger Angel, Joseph Epstein, Roger Kahn, but I mean, I could have picked out a dozen other ones. I mean, almost all baseball fans. Christy Mathewson, I had found a quote from him saying that it's mainly about losing, and also that this is also important because I think losing teaches us more about life than winning, since for all of us life is pretty much about losing. Not that we don't have our times of winning, but over time we're going to lose our parents, we lose sometimes our friends, we lose our health, we lose our memory, ultimately we lose our lives. So learning to live with the realities of human limitation, I think, increases one's wisdom and understanding of life, and I think baseball, especially if you're a Cub fan, helps you to see it. Sometimes George Willis said, I think about Roy Smalley, the Cub shortstop, who was a favorite of my mother's, but not a very good player, said that he learned from Smalley that life is a veil of tears, and he meant this to be a light remark, but there's a serious edge to it too, and I think Will also sees this, that there is much to be learned and about reality, about the reality of human limitation and human life from watching baseball and seeing your team lose. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that point really resonated with me. I coach a little league team, and last year I had a problem because many of the players would, so these are 9 and 10 year olds, they would cry after they struck out or after they got out, and I talked to the team, and it wasn't so much to say, your men, you can't cry, even though I had two girls on the team, your men, you can't cry about baseball. But I couched it in terms that you just discussed, that the very best players get on base 4 times out of 10 times, and the very best players only score once out of those 10 times. So 9 times out of 10 at-bats, you're going to accomplish what you set out to do, to get on base and to get around and score.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, as I mentioned early in our talk, that the most sobering moment for me about my baseball future was that I realized I couldn't pick up the ball as a curveball quick enough, just a fraction of a second too late. And as soon as I realized that, you know, I knew that that was it. I mean, I just couldn't see it quick enough. And, you know, it's good for young people to you know, not be a steady stream of self-esteem, so that and all of a sudden they're hit with the realities of life and find out that, well, the world doesn't revolve around them, and they do have weaknesses and as well as strengths, and that they do have limitations. And it seems to me the sooner we learned that early when I was a kid, and it kind of hurts at first, but it helps you down the line. That's so you don't grow up with these kinds of illusions that you know, you're better than you are. Mm-hmm.
So turning from literary aspects of baseball, I want to ask you about the science of baseball. And you don't discuss this so much in the book, but I have to believe that you, like most young baseball fans, were attentive to the numbers, to box scores and to batting averages and to statistics. So can you talk about what role does the science of baseball or the math of baseball play in our memory of the game?
That's a good question. I would say two things about that. I think that one of the things that the baseball fans love to do is talk about statistics, and they have remarkable memories for them. It's incredible. I have friends who have I have a fairly good memory for things like that, but I have friends who have better memories than I do for exactly what someone hit in a particular year. And we all remember that. Ted Williams hit 406 in 1941. You know that Joe DiMaggio hit safely in 56 straight games. I mean, we don't have to go to the record book to look those up. We remember them, and almost all fans remember. And I saw a new book on the streak by DiMaggio's streak the other day in the bookstore, and it just has the number 56 on it and a picture of DiMaggio. So we all know, anyone who cares about baseball knows what this means, and. So it's of course some people were good at keeping. I never kept score as much at Volpe because I missed too much of the action by writing and the keeping scores. But that's part of the pleasure that the game affords. I think is knowing about statistics. The records matter in baseball, and in a way that I don't think they do in other sports, or they don't so much. That's what's so devastating, or one of the things that's so devastating about the steroid scandal, because so many of these records now have been compromised. So we've got a player who holds both the lifetime and the single season home run record, and we know very well that, in fact, he's admitted that he used performance of steroids, and he's claimed he didn't know they were steroids, but no one really believes this. In any case, it's irrelevant. He used them. And so the records are tainted. And even in the case of the Red Sox finally winning a World Series, or two World Series, in the last decade, now we find out that Ramirez and Ortiz both used steroids. So, and they were the stars of the team. So, you know, even those records are compromised by these people. So I think that's a serious problem. The only other thing I would say about on the other side of the stat business is I'm not overly impressed with the sort of projects that Bill James carries out and the way that the manager of the Cardinals, De La Russa, plays the game, and that Will thinks is impressive, where they're sort of trying to calculate timing people, how long it takes them to get from first base to second base, timing the pitcher's motion. I'm not saying that this might pay some dividends, but in the end, to me, baseball is there's too much in baseball that can't be calculated scientifically, and too many actions that can't be predicted scientifically, and in the end, I'm not very enthusiastic about about managers who make decisions based on some kind of scientific calculation he's got on his computer. Mm-hmm.
So I want to ask you about what we remember about actual visits to baseball parks. And you and I have been talking before the interview that about the fact that I just went yesterday to a ballpark. I went to see the Detroit Tigers play the Minnesota Twins. I went with my two young sons. And I was sitting next to a man who was probably your age, who has season tickets. And, of course, one of the wonderful things about going to a baseball game is that you sit next to a complete stranger and you spark up a conversation that will last, that will just meander for about 3 hours with a perfect stranger, and then you end the conversation, you go your separate ways. So I learned from this man that he had grown up in Brooklyn and had gone to games at Ebbets Field. He then moved to Minneapolis and went to games at Old Met Stadium. Then he moved to Detroit and watch games at Tiger Stadium, and now he has season tickets at Comerica Park. And I said to him, I said, so I've just been reading a book about baseball and memory. With all of your years of going to games, what are the great standout plays, the great moments that you remember from the games he watched? And he paused and he thought and he said, you know, I don't really remember any great plays. He said, the thing I remember from Ebbets Field is that we could sit close to the field, close enough that we could talk to the right fielder. Mm-hmm. And after he said that, I was sitting with my sons and thinking about games that I had attended with my dad, I realized I don't remember that many plays either. I can't think of a lot of specific episodes on the field. And I'm going to bring this back to a point that you make in your book, that our memories of baseball, of being at the park, are much more expansive and more sensory than just what we see on the field or even the outcome of the game. Can you talk about that?
Yes. The experience of being at the ballpark certainly trumps any memory that we might have of particular plays. And although I think I do remember a handful of particular plays over the years that I saw, it is true that most of us would say pretty much what that gentleman told you at the ballpark the other day, that he can't remember a lot of specifics, but he does remember what it felt like to be in Ebbets Field in Brooklyn at the ball game, and everyone who was a Brooklyn Dodger fan and went to Ebbets Field says the same thing: the proximity that fans could be to the players, in the sense that they could even talk to them, they get so close to them, the experience of being in Wrigley Field for Cub fans is very similar to that. So that even though we suffered through most of the time when we were out there, the Cubs lost. Nevertheless, the experience of being at the ballpark and the memories that triggers for us, memories of going to the park with our father or with our friends, or even outside of that, it tends to expand into memories of what it was like to grow up in America in the 1950s, as opposed to what America has become now. So I think that's true of baseball, that it tends to lead, one memory leads to another. And one of the things I tried to do in the baseball book is to go from one memory to another, even though they were only not always intimately connected. But just the way the memory works, when you sit down and start thinking about things and remembering things, you remember one thing and that triggers a memory about something else. And pretty soon it's not just baseball anymore. It's a whole world that once existed. And those memories are precious to people, even though if they can't put their finger exactly on a specific thing. The whole atmosphere of a time and a place comes back to them. It means a lot to them because it's part of who they are as human beings, and part of who we are as a people.
Yeah, and there is, as you talk about in the book, and as you just said, there is something of a sadness about remembering something that's passed. So you came of age in the 50s going to baseball. I came of age in the 70s and early 80s going to baseball. But one thing that the person who was sitting next to me, he and I both really lamented about, is the noise that is in ballparks today. And I said to my sons Yeah, back when I used to go to games, it was just an organ between innings, and the, you know, the man who had gone to Ebbets Field sit next to me, he nodded along with me, and he had this same sense of disappointment of the loud music that plays between innings and before each player comes to bat.
That's right. I think the I was up just to Wrigley Field about 3 weeks ago, and the although they've done a pretty good job of keeping advertisements away as far as visual advertisements all over the park, they don't have that, but they do between innings do a lot of verbal advertising that's almost endless. The one of the disappointing things I think of the modern times is that the baseball is no longer the national pastime, and most people, especially young people, prefer other things, more frenetic sports like football when they're not standing around, and basketball, and for most people, including my children, baseball is too slow, too boring, and so what you get at ballpark now is not so much real fans as sort of entertainment seekers. They might as well be at a rock concert. I mean, baseball is just another entertainment, that's all. And some of these players, especially the drug users, were quite explicit about it. That was their belief. Bond said this, was the other guy, Canseco said this, Giambi said this. They all say the same thing. We thought of ourselves as entertainers, and, you know, you should let us entertain. We're nothing but entertainers. And in some ways, that's what baseball has become, except for those serious fans. It's just another form of entertainment. And I think, so you get it at the ballparks, a very different brand of person at the park. And also the big money is such that they have to do all this advertising. In fact, calling stadiums by the names of companies is a particular vulgarity that gets to me. But it's a very different feel when you go to the ballpark now than it was back in the 50s.
So I want to ask just one more thing or bring up an idea in terms of why the action on the field is a small part of our baseball memories. And I was reminded about this yesterday while watching the game, that baseball is a sport with really a limited scope of accomplishment. And so to give you examples, I saw an unheralded outfielder make a fantastic sliding catch. And then I saw a former MVP who had a ball go off his glove into the outfield for an extra base hit. There was a rookie catcher with an average below 200 who went 2 for 4 at the plate yesterday. And there was a future Hall of Famer who went 2 for 4 at the plate yesterday. And if I go to a game again in 10 years, 20 years, you'll see that similar range of failure and success. Great players with bad days, good players or average players with great days. And I think that this realization about baseball gets to a key theme in your book, and that's the theme of continuity in baseball.
Yes, I mean, those are big subjects. You're right. I mean, you find some days strictly mediocre players get the winning hit, and someone like Ted Williams plays in the World Series and it's 110 or whatever it was. I think one of the reasons that you get this is one thing that struck me about the contemporary game is that so many of the players are basically mediocre. That's because there's just not enough talent to go around. Some of these players would never, if there were only 16 teams, they would never made it to the major leagues. And you do see a lot of mediocre players who occasionally make a big play. But some of the catches, I've become a sort of a student of watching fabulous catches in the contemporary game. And there are some amazing catches that these guys make. Nevertheless, when you look at them, you look at the size of the gloves on their hands. When Willie Mays made the famous catch in the 1954 series, his glove was not very big. It was all Willie, pretty much. But in these games, these guys are carrying baskets around on their hands. They can leap up and stick that club up there. You know, they got a pretty good chance of having the ball lodge in it. So some of these catches would never have been made in the past because they just didn't have gloves these sides. On the continuity matter, this to me seems to be one of the great losses in baseball since the 1950s. So many people who take baseball seriously and remember the 50s talk about the continuity of their teams. The team, when you think of the famous Brooklyn Dodger teams, those same guys, you know, Hodges, Campy, Erskine, Jackie Robinson, Carl Grillo, Duke Snyder, they played together as a team for years and years. Now these guys bounce around for not one or two teams, but seven, eight, nine teams. So there's no continuity at all. Ralph Branca said once, well, I think people are just cheering for uniforms, not for teams. And this is a great loss because continuity is crucial to our appreciation of the team. We have a situation now where our worst enemy is, you know, plays for the other team, and then next year we get him and he's our first baseman. You know? And I think this has helped undermine the appeal of the game.
So you do talk about in your book some specific memories of episodes on the field, and I want to ask you about one of those specific baseball memories, a particular play. And this was from the game of April 18th, 1954, when the Cubs played the Cardinals. And I'm going to ask you to tell the story.
That story was one that I've often told to my friends, thinking that I was the only one who happened to remember it and not thinking it was any particular thing, except I was struck by it. But it turns out that this is a famous story often told about Stan Musial, and my memory of this was almost perfect, but not quite. I didn't remember the exact date, and I didn't remember that Paul Minor was the Cubs pitcher. But I happened to be at Wrigley Field that day, and Musial came up, apparently as a man on base, I didn't remember that. But he hit a ball that I remembered being a home run, but apparently was a double on the right field line in the corner at Wrigley Field, and the ump called the ball foul. And So Musial came back, and I can still see him standing there leaning on his bat at home plate. He exchanged a couple of words with the umpire just about what happened, but he didn't argue. But Eddie Stanky was then the manager of the Cardinals, and he came out and just went ballistic and screaming at the umpire. And this went on for several minutes before he was thrown out of the game. And with all the hubbub, furor died down. Musial stepped back in the box. I think it was the next pitch, but I'm not sure of that. But it was that same at bat. And he hit the ball almost in the exact same place, except clearly fair for a two-base hit. So that's just the story I've always remembered because it was so striking. That's one of the great baseball stories. And as I say, apparently this is a story that is often told about Stan, although sometimes people get it at the wrong ballpark, and I got the wrong kind of hit, but it was pretty close.
Okay, so I have a similar story, and I'm going to tell you my story, and then I'm going to have a question for you about our similar story. So my story, and this is one of the few plays or episodes on the field that I remember, I was at Yankee Stadium on July 17th, 1990. It was a game between the Yankees and the Royals. And this was the night that Bo Jackson hit three home runs in his first three at-bats. And I remember the home runs, but here's the twist. I was sitting in the right field bleachers, but for some reason I remember that the fans were yelling at Jackson when he came out to play in right field. And I remembered all three of the home runs landing within feet of each other in the right field bleachers. And like you, I later learned from a Joe Posnanski article that actually Jackson was playing center field and that the first of his homers went to center field and then the next two went to right field. And so as you acknowledged, your memory was almost perfect, but not quite. And as you said, other people have remembered that play with Musial as being in different ballparks. So this is something common with baseball fans, that we have a tendency to misremember or even embellish our memories from the ballpark. And I want to ask you, why do you think that is?
They do sometimes. I mean, people do tend to embellish memories, I think. And And otherwise, there's a certain amount of time passes, and so your memory can play some tricks on you. But nevertheless, the essence of the story, the meaning of the story, is still pretty clear in one's memory, so that the specific details might be off a little bit. But they don't change the fact that you do remember a significant event, and you remember pretty clearly that happened. This was 1954, it was a long time ago. And I can remember that quite clearly, except for the double home run business. But I don't know. I think that this only shows that people's memory is not perfect. But it's on things that really matter the most. Memories are pretty reliable. John Lukács, the Hungarian-born American historian, has described history as the remembered past, and I think that's true. And that means that we're never going to have the past exactly the way it happens. But that doesn't mean that it's all made up, and no memory is to be taken seriously. That's not true. Memories are largely to be taken seriously. It helps if there's some kind of confirming evidence, like Poznanski's piece for both of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I like that phrase that you had. The meaning, even though our memories are wrong, the meaning of our memories is the same. That in both instances we witnessed a great feat by a baseball player, and though we got the details right, it doesn't erase the fact that what we saw was outstanding.
That's right.
So in many places in the book, you talk about your individual memories of games and people. Is there such a thing as shared or collective memory, and how does that function in regards to baseball?
I think there clearly is shared memory, and that's one of the pleasures that the game affords, is that we have, with other fans who are serious, many shared memories. And I have many. I grew up with a bunch of guys who were also Cub fans in the suburbs of Chicago, and our memories are pretty much very similar of things that we remember. Again, the details sometimes elude us, but the general meaning of particular events or the general atmosphere of what it was like to go to a game in Wrigley Field in the 1950s are remarkably similar. And it had an effect of not only sort of reinforcing the fact that we're not delusional, but also it's one of the things that bind us together as friends and ultimately as a nation. If we're going to have a nation, it requires that we have some shared memories, and that are not, every one of which is not being challenged or shown to be false or something like that. I mean, since that's not true in the first place, but those shared memories are help hold us together as a people, and they help to forge friendships and even casual meetings like you had with the gentleman at the ballpark are important, because they show that there are other people out there who care about the game and have similar enthusiasm and some similar memories that you have too.
So you talk about the positive aspects of shared memory, and my next question relates to the negative aspects. And so both you and I study a part of the world, Eastern Europe, where collective memories can be twisted and end up having a toxic effect on societies. So in the experience of baseball fans or sport fans, is there the possibility of a shared or collective memory that likewise has a damaging or a dysfunctional effect on the community?
I think not if the memories are not purposely being manipulated for political ends. I mean, as you know full well, what went on during the communist period in Eastern Europe was that, and what that Kundera points out so well, is that there was a kind of organized effort to throw things down the memory hole that were inconvenient or make people non-persons. And When memory is being used for political purposes like that, yeah, it is toxic. But when memory is approached honestly and without political ends and views, I think it's all a good thing. With one exception, there is something that Paul Ricoeur calls sort of reconciled memory. which I take it he means by this forgiveness and memories that exclude forgiveness and personal relations are not a good thing. I think there is a kind of excessive memory of certain things, usually things, harm that has been done to you by somebody that you can't let go of can often disrupt a life, and it can be toxic. Nietzsche wrote someplace that it's we need a certain amount of forgetting. I mean, and of course it would be a nightmare if we remember. There are people apparently who remember virtually every moment of every day of the last 40 years of their life, which would be a total nightmare, of course. So that, yeah, you could have too much of memory, and it'd be too much of a good thing, I think. But for most of us, that's not the problem now. Our problem now is that there's this kind of national amnesia, young people really don't seem to remember anything or feel that they're responsible for anything that happened before they were born.
All right, so my final question is, what are you working on now?
I'm working on a book on Alexander Solzhenitsyn and primarily on his relationship with the Orthodox Church in Russia. And my wife and I are Orthodox, and so I'm interested in the sort of the Soviets' attacks on Christianity and Solzhenitsyn's response to that. So that's sort of what I'm working on.
So that's quite a range of topics that you've written about, that from Hungarian socialist intellectuals to baseball and now to Solzhenitsyn.
Yeah, I guess it comes from, you know, I taught at a school where I had to teach lots of different subjects, and when I worked at Britannica, I had to write about a lot of subjects, most of which I really shouldn't have been because I didn't know that much about it, but that was a job, and so I, you know, just developed interest in a lot of things, and I still write about Hungarian subjects, but mainly in book reviews and short essays.
Mm-hmm. And do you get to games much now?
Not very often, no. I've been to one game up in D.C. at the new Nationals Park, and I did get to Wrigley Field because it was our college reunion we went back for, and so we got out to Wrigley Field, but I don't get to many games. My interest in the game is I still like to watch the playoffs, but my interest, because my opinion of the modern game is so low that I don't follow the game as anywhere near as closely as I used to growing up.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, I will say I enjoyed the book. As I said, I was just at a game yesterday, so it was interesting for me. It was illuminating to watch the game after having read your book and your ideas about baseball and memory, and to think about the game in a different way. And in particular, as I was sitting between someone who had grown up watching games at Ebbets Field, and then on my other side were my two sons, whom I was bringing to to one of their first baseball games. So it really did, your book did heighten my experience of going to the game yesterday. So I thank you for that.
Well, thank you very much, Bruce. I appreciate that.
All right, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to an interview with Lee Congdon about his book, Baseball and Memory, Winning, Losing, and the Remembrance of Things Past, published by St. Augustine's Press. New Books in Sports is part of the New Books Network, which offers more than 70 channels of podcast interviews with the authors of new publications. If you like what you heard, please visit the Facebook page for New Books in Sports, where you can give us your feedback, get announcements of new interviews, and find links to thoughtful sports writing from around the world. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Thank you for listening, and enjoy your week.